NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Well, hello, John.
Yeah, we're at it again. We don't have any Greg today. He's off and about somewhere. You have picked a very good accident. I was just reading it over for the last little bit before we had our conversation. And a lot of this material in here I remember from years ago.
And some of this material was reminiscent of some of the things I did years ago as well. But this is a 2022 accident, June 22, 2022, at Amsterdam, West Virginia. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. This was a UH-1B helicopter, which was a Vietnam-era warbird. It was in Vietnam from 62 to 71. In later life, it had an opportunity to be a warbird demonstration aircraft. Going to air shows, people pay a little bit of money. They can either ride in the back, pay a little bit more money. You could ride in the cockpit with the pilot. And in this particular case, there were six people on board the helicopter, including a person who had helicopter experience, who was in the right seat as the pilot. And in helicopters, basically the pilot in command position is the right side, and the co-pilot or the second pilot is on the left side, opposite of what you would see in a fixed-wing aircraft. There was an engine problem, and one of the pilots, it's not clear whom, attempted to make an emergency landing and unfortunately was unsuccessful, hit power lines, went semi-inverted on a road, a crash caught fire, and everyone was killed. But as we peeled away the layers of this, there were a lot of things about this which called into question how exactly flights like this have been managed by the FAA and the role that the FAA plays in that and the roles that the people who fly and manage these aircraft play in that. And to make a longer story short, this was a Part 91 flight with paying passengers. And yes, that is possible to do so. There are exemptions for that for regular airplane flights. If I'm flying my Cessna and I want people to fly with me and help me defer the cost of flying, that I can do. If I want to charge tickets like I'm taking from point A to point B like an airline, I can't do that. That's Part 91. But in the exemption for this kind of flying, an experimental certificate on this aircraft, this was something that could be done to offset the cost of flying. You can have whomever to go in there in the aircraft and fly. But John, there are a whole lot of things that we were discussing about this and unrolling about this. And what are some of the things that really jumped out at you at this, about event?
Taking it a step at a time. First off, the FAA in general has been very generous to this warbird community as far as complying with the rules. And part of that, the public wanted that, the public loves military shows, air shows in particular. So there's been a bit of a public demand to experience the military type airplanes, to fly in them. So we had, some of our audience may remember that we had that B-17 crash in Hartford, Connecticut, with I think there was 9 people on board, and I forget exactly, but There were people on board that made a donation to fly in the airplane. And that's how they pay to get the air, take it around to all the show circuit. and around. We had another one crash at an air show where I think it was in Texas, where they had a mid-air collision and took on another B-17. So, and for whatever reason, the FAA really hasn't moved in to close the door on these airplanes. But there is a few things that they could have done better under existing rules and not shut these operations down. But, you know, one of the things, of course, whenever I look at an accident, one of the first things I look at is the maintenance. And this operation was pretty loose on their maintenance. In fact, I can't believe that they were still flying, other than the fact that the FAA claimed that they didn't even have it on their work schedule to visit this place and see and review the records. So it looks like it may have fallen through the cracks unintentionally. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, unintentionally. And it was being maintained under a set of rules that was designed for virtually general aviation airplanes, Pipers and Cessnas, little airplanes, and only requiring a 100-hour inspection with no real detailed inspection requirements. Now, these helicopters are turbine-powered. So turbine engines, although they're very reliable, when they go bad, they go boom. To just allow this airplane to fly with this engine, there's no record and not in the report. I didn't see a record of how many hours since overhaul on this engine, but this was a 1962 helicopter, so guaranteed it's had a few engine changes. Now, it's been flying for 60 years. There's no engine that turbine engine that's going to fly for 60 years. Although they are reliable, they think, you know, under certain conditions. I can remember one JT8D had 18,000 hours on it and still going. So it can happen, but it's not typical. So the first thing that jumped out is trying to maintain a complex system. Helicopters are complex by nature. Helicopter engines are also complex, like any turbine engine, but they also have an awful lot of strain on them. They're turboshaft engines, and you can surge the engine. The load can go up, can go down, depending on how you fly the helicopter. So there's a lot of variables in the life cycle of an engine on a helicopter, and to allow it to be inspected under Part 43 of the Federal Air Regulations is crazy.
It's crazy. Another thing that jumped out at me about this was the pilot in command, a 53-year-old pilot who was a private pilot certificate with a helicopter rating and rotorcraft gyroplane rating, who, and again, there are several things about the pilot. Let's start with the pilot's experience. The logbook noted 493 hours of flight experience, of which 21 hours was in this particular model of helicopter. And in the past 12 months, he had only 12 total hours of his total of 20 in this helicopter. And he had 6.5 hours in the previous 3 months, 90 days rather, and 3.4 hours in the previous 30 days. Now, in my opinion, that's a rather minimal number of hours to maintain proficiency in any aircraft. But there are other things about this. His stepson, who's a flight instructor, was saying that, you know what? He didn't put all of his hours in his logbook. He had more experience than that. And in fact, this pilot listed in his recent medical that he had 1,400 hours of experience. Whether the number is 1,400 or 493, it seemed to me a little bit odd that someone would have that much of a discrepancy between what they put in their logbook and what they've actually done. I'm not the most detailed person in the world, but I try and keep my logbook at least relevant to what I've actually done and make sure that record is kept up to date within a few days of me flying at the most. It would be unusual for me to forget basically 2/3 of my flight hours and not put them in the logbook. And on top of that, and this is even more telling, the sequence of events in this accident was there was an engine problem. There was an attempt to do an emergency landing. According to the stepson, or according to the report rather, this pilot had not, to their knowledge, practiced emergency procedures such as auto rotations or transferring control of the aircraft from the flying passenger to the pilot in command. And recall that in this particular accident, the person sitting in the right seat of this helicopter was a passenger who paid extra money in order to fly that helicopter for a planned 30 minutes. The problem that happened about 15 minutes into this. And also, this was in a mountainous, hilly terrain sort of situation. So again, this was a challenging environment to do an emergency landing. And the pilot in command apparently had not had a lot of practice performing an emergency landing or an autorotation in this helicopter.
You would think if he flew that much time that he would want to do that. You have to take it all with a grain of salt. The logbook time we know would be more accurate, but it could be low because he didn't record it. In 1,400 hours, he should have been practicing auto rotations, especially in that terrain. But also auto rotations take its toll on the airframe. If they were trying to nurse this airplane along, they may not want to pull it because it does strain the engine, strains the transmission as well as the rotor blades. And it's very easy to make a mistake that can cause you to lose the helicopter in an auto rotation situation.
Now, to the pilot's credit, the pilot did have experience flying in this particular manner because this particular airshow type event, which was in 2022, he had flown this same helicopter in 2020 and 2021. So this was not unfamiliar to this person, how to fly the helicopter in that environment. But again, the recency of experience and the amount of experience in this helicopter, in my opinion, was rather low.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We have to take what's in his logbook. Now, the other thing that popped out at me with this in the maintenance arena was that it's under 43. The only thing required is an annual inspection or a 100-hour inspection if they fly more than 100 hours. It appears that it didn't fly more than 100 hours in the year from what they have in the report. So it was only required to have an annual inspection. It was 5 days away from the expiration of the last annual inspection. So it was coming up for one. There's some records that they change the oil, which is a step in doing a annual inspection. So it looks like they were gearing up to do the inspection, but it wasn't done yet, at least not by the records.
And just to be clear, this is something we talked about before we went on the air. The previous inspection was June 17th, 2021. This accident happened June 22nd, 2022, a year and 5 days. But you were saying that there's some leeway, that is, you can go beyond the 1 year under certain circumstances. So they might not have been out of compliance with that particular part of the FAA of the regulations.
Yes, if there's a procedure in place where you can get a small extension, but they would have to go to the FAA to do that.
But then again, the FAA had a set of regulations for inspecting this aircraft that was not as extensive as it could have been. To be more precise, the experimental certificate on this aircraft was issued during a particular level of requirements for inspection. Between that time and the time of the accident, those inspection requirements had gone up. However, because this certificate on the aircraft predated that, they were not required to inspect it under the new, more stringent regulations.
Yeah, that's not uncommon on old airplanes. But here we have a set of mix and match rules too. When you buy an airplane, if you were to go out and buy a 1960 Cessna, the maintenance manual that came with that airplane is all you're required to do. The only way to put an additional requirement on that is an AD note. Not a service bulletin, an AD note. And that's because the FAA has to take into consideration economic impact on their rules. So if they put a rule in that has a severe economic impact, it's not going to be applied backwards unless they put an AD on it. So there's a lot of nuances to those rules. And I'm talking in general terms now, not specific.
Now, there's also a question of whether or not there's a compelling reason to make those sort of rule changes for this model of the Huey. There have been variations of the UH-1 and follow-ons that were much more sophisticated that have been in production for decades. But the fact of the matter is, this model of helicopter, there were roughly 7,000 that were made and sent over to Vietnam. Roughly 3,000 of them were destroyed. Some number of them came back and were in service in various military units in the States. There's still a handful of them out there, literally a handful, because The Army no longer uses them. Even the Air National Guard, the Army National Guard, phase out these helicopters. They're a handful in use in the military world. Of course, there are others in use, with police helicopters, firefighting, etc. But this is not a mainline, high production, current model helicopter. So even if there was an issue that was seen to be a fleet-wide potential safety issue, because of the numbers that are out there being flown by civilians and military organizations, there may not be that much of a push to do a major change in regulations.
Yes, the FAA does tend to lighten up with the old airplanes and pushing them, because you're going to push them out of the skies, essentially. It's one thing to have your own, J2 Piper Cub that you fly around and you're not getting, there's no passengers on board. You know, it has one seat, so you got somebody, the friend of yours, that would fly, and basically he's not paying for that privilege to fly. So that's, one reason why they would be sort of forgiving with that airplane, with the rules that it flies under. But this airplane is going to be flying a bunch of people around, and it should be. And of course, if you read further down into the report, this thing fell through the cracks with the FAA. They didn't even know it was operating, even though they issued the certificate to allow it to operate. They never had it on their agenda to surveil it. By that, I mean the FAA, when they have it, they prepare their work product for the year, they put down where they're going to go and who they're going to visit. And that's part of their work agenda. And it was not on anybody's work agenda. So it was just approved and was just out there. So this operator had plenty of latitude to get himself into trouble.
Now let's look at the other side of this, the demand side of this. Who would want to fly in these aircraft? All kinds of people. I remember when I lived in Seattle, every year the Navy had the Seafair activities every August, where you would have all sorts of Blue Angels and whatnot. And part of that was you would have a B-17, I believe, from, the company, Collins Aerospace, or what was the name?
Collins Foundation.
Collins. It would fly this B-17 out, be advertised in the local papers, local news, saying, hey, you want to fly in the B-17? For $500, you can take a ride in the B-17. Now, I'm of an age that grew up watching old World War II movies and watching 12 O'Clock High on television. So it was kind of interesting to me. It's like, gee, I have $500. I've got some time in my hands. I'd like to maybe fly in a B-17. Fact of the matter is, I never went and did it, even though I had several opportunities to do so over the years, because I said to myself, is it really worth it for me to go out and do that? And I was on the fence. Let's say I did do that. I can tell you for a fact, I would not have done any deep dive into the history of the organization or of that aircraft, or asked questions like, well, is the FAA doing oversight of this aircraft? No. My thought is, B-17, $500, little riding around Seattle, land and have some stories to tell. That's it. And I'm somebody who's in the aviation safety world, and that would have been my mentality. So the average person would probably have my attitude, or even more, let's just say, loosey-goosey about what are the questions I should ask of this organization or this pilot before I get on board this aircraft or this helicopter?
Nobody ever does, and I never did on the ones that I got on. Right? In fact, when I was learning to fly, I didn't. If someone said, you want to go flying, I never would do check anything. I'd be the first one in the airplane because I wanted to fly. Yes, it's crazy in hindsight. When I was a teenager, I was fearless. That's why wars are fought with young people.
And even those who were, let's say, not quite teenagers, but in their 20s, like I was in my 20s. When I was in the Air Force, I was stationed at Edwards Air Force Base as a flight test engineer. My initial jobs were sitting behind a desk. Well, heck, I'm at the flight test center at Edwards. I don't want to be behind a desk. So I figured out a way to go out and support the mission in various support flights, including flights in a UH-1 Huey. And one of the things that struck me was the first time I went out to the aircraft, I could see like visible repaired battle damage, because this was a helicopter that had a decade or so before had been in Vietnam, come back to the States, and was still in service in a support role in the Air Force. And I had a couple of questions in my head about, well, geez, is this airplane okay since it's been shot up and repaired? But once we started flying, I didn't think much about it. But it did impress me that this was a much larger helicopter than my mind's eye had it being from all the TV and movie shows I've seen about the helicopter. And there were a lot of things about that that made it a challenging machine to fly. And we had to understand well enough how to deal with a certain emergency situation to get ourselves out of the helicopter, should it land hard or roll or what have you. So it wasn't a very casual thing to fly in this. This was something where all the crew members, even those who weren't pilots, had to be on top of their game and had their roles to play.
Well, this is a very unfortunate accident because it never should have happened. The FAA should have been on their game, should have been watching this. This NTSB really came down hard on the NTSB with their recommendations. Even the verbiage that the NTSB used, FAA's adequate inspection and maintenance standards. I mean, that's a pretty damning start of a recommendation. And then it goes on to talk about more rigorous standards which do exist. They only had to apply them, and they really went after them for their lack of oversight for this operation. And I hope the FAA got their act together because there's a lot more Lloyd's operations. I do know that the one operator that's up here in the New England region, the FAA does visit them quite often. But how much do they push on them? I don't know. And let's not forget that many of the inspectors in the FAA came from the military. So they may have a warm spot in their heart for those airplanes and not really looking at beyond the airplane and not seeing how it's being used.
Now, there is one thing about this investigation that also caught my eye, but more from an administrative point of view. We review all sorts of NTSB investigations on this podcast. Some of them are fairly short, 5, 10, 15 pages. And on occasion, you have the very major investigative reports of airliner crashes and whatnot. But this is something different. This was an aviation investigation report, an AIR-24-04. And how is this level of investigation different from the typical general aviation investigation or the major investigation we'd see for an airliner?
Well, there's a lot more detail in this investigation than you normally see in a typical GA accident investigation. So, for whatever reason, the NTSB came in and really did a look at this. Now, this was June of 22.
That's correct. And it was released August of this year, August of 2024.
So, it's at the end of the fiscal year when their money is really tight. So, for them to put this level of detail on this, they must have had something that really caught their eye. It's not obvious from reading the report, but having been there, I can tell you that with the budget crunch that they have, they being the staff of the NTSB, have shared with me, it's a bit surprising that this late in the fiscal year that they spent that much money on this investigation. So something must have caught their eye. We banged the FAA up pretty good. The NTSB banged them up. We talked about the shortfalls of these type of operations. It may be beneficial for the average person, enthusiast, to really take a look at these operations with a jaundiced eye before you get on the airplane. I mean, there's not much you can do when you're out at an airport and they're offering you a ride on one of these and you're excited because you'd like to do it. There's not much you can do, but you really got to be careful.
And this segues into my next to last word in that, like you said, this is a situation where there's excitement on the part of the potential passengers to do this. So they're not going to be thinking about FAA oversight top of mind. But clearly, the NTSB did. Is this going to be enough to get the FAA to change their tune when it comes to other organizations like this and other flight operations similar to this? It's a big question in my head, and I'm not sure if it would, simply because the fairly small number of people who are involved in this, both on the providing side and as the customer side, and the potential effects on aviation safety. We've already had the two major B-17 crashes, one of them with passengers on board. So if there is any impetus to change the FAA oversight of this is already happening as we speak. Again, it's going to be up to those operators to do better at what they're doing and up to passengers to think twice before they go on a ride.
And for my last word, I'll continue with what I've been saying for the last 4 years of whatever it is, a long time. And interestingly, I'm going to talk about, as I always do, pre-flights, but also pre-planning your flight. But recently, I've been seeing in other publications, they're finally starting to talk about doing an adequate pre-flight. I noticed one a couple months ago. I noticed the second one, and just today, I noticed the third one. Three different organizations finally picking up the mantle about these pre-flights. So if you're going to go flying, plan your flight. Plan before you get to the airport. When you get to the airport, do it again and make sure everything is still the same. When you get out to the airplane, do an adequate pre-flight. If you think you're not doing a very good job or you want to reassure yourself that you are doing a good job, find a mechanic and ask them what they would look for. And after you get in the airplane, put your head on a swivel. The skies are crowded around GA airports with a lot of inexperienced people trying to build time. So please put that head on a swivel and fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.